to stand between them and their enemies, to die if that was the only way to save them. Most of them never spared the Navy a thought in peacetime. Of those who did, many complained bitterly about funds the fleet diverted from other expenditures. But that changed nothing. It was her job to keep them safe enough they could afford to feel that way about her, and she'd never fully realized how deep her sense of responsibility cut until she'd been forced to abandon millions of them to horrible death. Now she did, and she wondered, in the night, while she waited for the nightmares to come, how many more worlds she could abandon before she broke. She gazed down into the plot for endless minutes, searching for an answer. But no answer came, and at last she drew a deep breath, turned, and walked from the flag bridge to her cabin. The light cruisers of the assault fleet formed up. It had taken the survey ships less time than usual to locate the warp point. The enemy's attempts to use small craft as spies had helped, but the staggering losses the fleet had so far suffered had delayed its timetable. Yet it was ready now, and its ships floated silently in space, ready to resume the advance at last. The alarm's wail yanked her from her sleep, and she jerked upright even as one hand reached automatically for the inhaler. She fumbled it to her face, then squeezed the button and gasped as a fiery pinwheel exploded in her brain. The stimulant was as brutal as the surgeon had warned it would be, but it smashed the drugged fog from her mind, and she shook herself fiercely. She tossed the inhaler aside and activated her bedside comm.
"Talk to me. They're coming through, sir."
It was Leroy McKenna's grim voice, and she wondered what he was doing on Flagbridge at this hour. Was he having as much trouble sleeping as she?
"Strength," she demanded, shoving the blankets aside. "Only their light cruisers so far," McKenna said tensely. "Plotting makes it 75+ of them. I expect we'll see the big sucker shortly, sir."
"Understood. On my way." She cut the comm circuit and climbed into her vac suit, wincing in pain as she made the plumbing connections with ruthless haste. There was a preternatural sharpness to her thoughts, a gift, no doubt, from the stim. Yet even with that edge, if edge it was, she couldn't understand the bug's tactics. Surely K-45 had taught them she wouldn't risk a point-blank defense. And if none of her ships lay within the cruiser's engagement envelope, taking losses from interpenetration was pointless. She snatched up her helmet and headed for the hatch at a run. Maybe the bastards were simply slaves to the book. Despite herself, her lips quirked as she pictured a bug admiral with the book open in front of him, eye stalks cocked as he ran the tip of a tentacle down the type. But the smile vanished quickly. That many light cruisers might indicate a commensurate increase in capital ships, and there was nothing at all humorous about that. 90 cruisers made transit. 71 survived the experience, and their sensors scanned the space about the warp point while courier drones raced back to confirm transit. There were none of the mines that had cost their fellows so dear in the last battle, and they moved outward, englobing the warp point at one light second's range.
McKenna and Ling Tian were bent over the master plot when Murakuma stepped onto Flagbridge and Demosthenes Waldeck looked down from a bulkhead comm screen.
Jackson Teller's face filled another screen, and Rear Admiral John Ludendorff, who'd arrived with the Borzoi and Kodiak-class fleet carriers, occupied another from the bridge of TFNS Polar Bear. Although senior to Teller, Ludendorff had readily agreed to serve as the junior admiral's exec rather than shake up TF-59's command team.
McKenna started to speak as Murakuma strode quickly to the plot, but her raised hand stopped him long enough for her eyes to devour the icons.
The bug CLs had spread out about the warp point, and a long lethal line of super dreadnoughts had begun to flow through in their wake.
"Is Admiral Cusack ready?" she asked him then.
"Yes, sir. She's standing by for your order."
"Good." Murakuma watched the display a moment longer, then nodded.
"Tell her to do it," she said flatly.
"Yes, sir," Ling Tian replied, and Murakuma racked her helmet on the side of her command chair and watched her repeater plot as she seated herself.
Her ship's icons blinked from the amber of standby to the flashing brilliance of general quarters, and the ready fighters spat from her carrier's catapults. But her eyes dropped to the light codes representing the 5 OWPs, which had orbited Justin A-3 until she demanded enough turbine-class fleet tugs to move them to within 10 light seconds of the warp point. Turbines were more powerful than civilian tugs, able to give the immobile OWPs a velocity equal to any bug ships. Just as importantly, they mounted light shields, point defense, and data link. They could be brought inside the OWP's data nets, and their skippers had orders to keep their ponderous charges between them and the enemy.
In effect, Murakuma had turned the forts into a mobile support force, and her lips skinned back at the thought.
Each of those OWPs was the size of a super dreadnought, and none of its 108,000 tons were devoted to the engines an SD required. Four were pure missile platforms, with standard missiles, not capital launchers, unfortunately, and the fifth was the command base, with a pure energy armament to support its master data link and deep space control systems. Its heterodyne lasers were powerful weapons, but she doubted she was going to get much use out of them, which didn't bother her. Given the unorthodox strategy she'd evolved, the command base was about to prove worth its weight in any precious substance someone cared to name. And each standard base had the offensive missile power of an entire battle group of Belial-class battleships. She'd had to break them into two battle groups and use Admiral Kuzak's Cottonmouth as the second group's command ship, but they'd be able to throw an awesome number of missiles once they engaged. For the moment, however, her attention was on the command OWP. She'd exhausted her supply of mines in K-45, but someone up the logistics pipeline had scraped up something even better for this fight. 100 small buoys floated in a thin shell, 6 light seconds from the warp point. There were so few of them, and they were so widely dispersed, the bugs might not have picked them up at all. Even if they had, they'd probably assumed they were laser buoys, a threat, but an acceptable one. Only they weren't laser buoys. They were independently deployed primary beam platforms, and the command base had just ordered them to engage. 4 seconds passed while the order sped to the nearest buoys, then another 20 while they waited until their more distant brothers received the command base's targeting setup and confirmed their readiness to the master buoys. And then, in one terrible instant, 100 primary beams stabbed out in a single deadly salvo. The lead super-dreadnought staggered as unstoppable stilettos stabbed through shields and armor with contemptuous ease, and the SDs, safely outside the enemy's range, had made no effort to take evasive action. Over 70 primaries scored direct hits on the 10 lead ships. The narrow focus weapons punched tiny holes, little more than 5 centimeters across, but they punched those holes through anything, including magazines. The beams ripped into the stored warheads. Containment fields ruptured. Matter met antimatter, and a deadly chain reaction tore through every warhead aboard the targeted ships. "Yes!" Leroy McKenna's exultant hiss filled Cobra's flag bridge as fireballs glared on the warp point,
and Murakuma's fist slammed down on her command chair's armrest.
She'd hoped to hurt the bastards, but her most optimistic prediction had fallen short of this. 10 clear kills. 10 in the opening salvo. By God, she might be able to stop them after all. "Ready, Jackson?" she asked, looking up at Teller's comm screen.
"Ready, sir." The carrier admiral's fierce exultation matched her own, and she nodded.
"Send them in," she said, and glanced at Waldeck. "Engage the enemy, Admiral Waldeck."
For just a moment, even the bugs seemed paralyzed by the destruction visited upon their battle line's van. Then the first Terran missile salvos began to rip into them, even as their sensors detected the closing signatures of 260 strike fighters, and the globe of light cruisers moved closer to the warp point to screen the emerging line of super-dreadnoughts.
"Jesus, look at that bastard!"
Commander Oliveira nodded grimly. He was the backup strike commander this time, and that gave him too much leisure to observe the light cruiser Lieutenant J.G. Carlton Hathaway had centered on his display.
The damned thing must mount nothing but point defense, because it was putting out 3 times the defensive fire of a Belial-class BB. And that was bad. Very bad.
"How many of them do you see?" he asked tautly.
"I make it at least 15, Skip. Probably more. What the hell is that thing?"
"How the fuck do I know?" Olivero demanded harshly, then shrugged.
"Hell, maybe it's a minesweeper, if it matters."
He glanced at Lieutenant Malachi, his command fighter's pilot.
"I hope you're feeling agile, Jane."
"As a weasel, Skip."
Malachi was the quintessential fighter jock. Her voice only got calmer as the tension rose, and Oliveira managed a tight smile,
then looked back at the TAC officer. "Punch up the alternate command net, Carl."
Hathaway nodded in grim understanding. Gloved fingers danced across his panel, and Oliveira bent over his own, setting up a running download from the strike leader in case he had to take over.
"We've got a new light cruiser class, sir."
Lin Tiang's voice was clipped, but sudden worry burned in its depths.
"It appears to be an anti-missile ship or minesweeper. Whatever it is, it's got at least 50% more point defense than a Dunedin."
Something inside Murakuma flinched. The Dunedin-class escort light cruisers were anti-missile platforms designed to bolster the defenses of light carrier or battle-line battlegroups. CLEs were fragile compared to a capital ship,
but mounted enormously powerful point defense for their size, which made them extremely efficient at killing missiles, or fighters.
"Switch the Matterhorns and OWPs to them." "Aye, aye, sir."
Murakuma bit her lip as Ling's acknowledgement came back to her.
She hated taking her bases and handful of super dreadnoughts off the bug heavies, yet those CLEs would wreak havoc among her fighters, and the OWPs and Matterhorns were her best chance to take them out. The bases had the sheer volume of fire to saturate their defenses, and the penetration aids of the Matterhorn's capital missiles might just let them sneak through.
And it wouldn't take many hits with second-generation AM warheads to blow a light cruiser apart. She bit her lip harder. Should she recall the strike, wait until she'd had a chance to whittle away at this unanticipated threat? The casualties her strike groups were about to take said yes, but if she pulled back now, she lost her best, possibly her only chance, to actually stop the bastards. The warp point was a holocaust of exploding warheads, ripping at the incoming capital ships. She'd already killed 10, and half a dozen more were bleeding air. If she could just hit them hard enough, savage them terribly enough, surely even bugs would break off. Her long-dead husband's face flickered before her, and she closed her eyes, fighting Tadayoshi aside while options and costs and possibilities cascaded through her brain. Even if she pulled them back now, they might take equally heavy losses later, she told herself. If she backed off on the strike, let the capital ships make transit in strength, the defensive fire would be almost as terrible even if every CLE were blown apart. But the decisive factor, the one she simply could not ignore, was timing. The possibility of getting the fighters in quickly enough, in sufficient strength, to stop the enemy dead and save 9 million civilians. She opened her eyes once more and watched the fighter icons streaking towards the holocaust, and said nothing.
"It's gonna be a rough ride, Skipper," Hathaway said flatly, and Oliveira nodded.
Whatever their designed purpose, the bug cruiser's defenses made them missile sponges. They were soaking up enormous volumes of fire, and diverting TF-59's fire from the bug battle line when its transit-stabilized units were at their most vulnerable.
"Entering their envelope in 15 seconds.
The TAC officer's voice was flatter than ever, and Oliveira felt his guts tighten. The fighters slammed into the bug's defensive globe.
The fighters slammed into the bug's defensive globe, and Vanessa Murakuma's face went white as every light cruiser opened fire simultaneously.
The CLEs were the most effective, but the class ops had codenamed Carbine was almost as bad. They didn't have the AFHAWK, thank God, but they didn't really need the specialized anti-fighter missile, not when they had enough sprint-mode standard missiles to go around. The bug cruisers had to be extremely austere designs, she thought almost calmly, without the support systems Terran designers included as a matter of course. If they were regarded as expendable throwaways, that actually made sense, and it also meant the tonnage they didn't use for self-protection could be diverted to offensive purposes. The Carbine's missile broadsides were twice as heavy as a TFN light cruiser's, and she watched in horror as they ripped into her fighters.
"Coming up on our final turn, Skip!"
Hathaway's voice was jagged with tension, and nausea swirled in Oliveira's belly as Malachi went to full power and evasive action, and a savage fist crushed him back in his couch. No one had ever figured out how to build a fighter inertial compensator with the efficiency of a starship's or even a larger small craft's. Fighters were the smallest, fastest, most agile deep space craft ever designed, and the engineers had been forced to accept some fundamental compromises to offset the acceleration effects, which would otherwise have turned any human passenger into gruel. In effect, a fighter's inertial sump was shallower than that of anything else in space. It worked, but it didn't work as well as those of larger units, and that was what made fighter ops so physically punishing when they went to full power. Malachi took them into the teeth of the enemy's fire at Point 2C, and Oliveira felt another colder nausea twist his gut as fighters began to die.
I should have called them back.
The icy thought burned in Vanessa Murakuma's brain as dozens of Terran fighters exploded.
I should have called them back.
But she hadn't, and her hands locked on her command chair's armrests like talons as her bleeding squadrons continued to close.
Captain Brigada's gone, Hathaway barked, and Oliveira nodded.
Rampart Strike, this is Rampart 2,
he said over the net while the giant's fist crushed him back and anti-acceleration drugs fought his body's abuse.
Maintain profile. We're going in.
Half the fighters were already dead when the survivors broke through the cruisers, and more died as they charged across the final light seconds towards their targets. Clumsy, waddling super dreadnoughts tried to turn aside even as their own weapons lashed at their attackers, but this was what Rampart Strike had come for. It would not be denied, and broken bits of squadrons bucked and bounced through the curdled space in the SD's wake. The warp point was a mad confusion of fishtailing fighters and swerving capital ships, bug jammers overpowered squadron data nets. Light cruisers turned to follow them into the madness, point defense firing furiously, while the Terran missiles it was ignoring roared in to kill them. And even as Rampart Strike closed, fresh super dreadnoughts continued to make transit into the maelstrom. No computer could have sorted it all out, but that no longer mattered. Rampart Strike survivors swerved into the blind spots of their victims, and Oliveira knew there would be too few left for a second strike like this. They had to get close. So close not a shot missed, for it was the only pass they were going to get.
Visual range,
he barked over the net.
Visual range launch!
Holy Mary, Mother of God, blessed art thou among women,
Carlton Hathaway whispered as an enemy dreadnought loomed on his targeting screen. The range was less than 100,000 kilometers, and it flashed downward like lightning with the fighter's overtake velocity as Malachi lined up. The TAC officer's hand rested on the control panel built into the armrest of his flight couch, and the ball of one gloved thumb reached for the big red button.
Pray for us sinners at—
The SD appeared suddenly on his visual display, and his thumb jabbed.
Birds away,
he screamed, and threw up into his helmet as Jane Malachi redlined her drive in a vicious hairpin turn. Four antimatter-armed close attack missiles blasted from the fighter, roaring down on the SD, and eight more missiles followed them in, from the only other two survivors of Oliveira's original squadron. All 12 scored direct hits. There was no wreckage.
Vanessa Murakuma's bleak, frozen eyes watched the fragments of Jackson Teller's fighters fall back to their carriers.
They'd killed 16 SDs, and plotting estimated that they'd inflicted heavy damage on 6 more. But they'd paid for it with almost 70% of their number, and it was her fault. She stared into her own soul, loathing what she saw, then made herself accept it and set it aside. There would be time to face her dead later. She drew a deep breath and looked back into her plot. They'd put the next best thing to 30 super dreadnoughts out of action, but that many more were already in system, and more were making transit as she watched. It was unbelievable. Whatever she did, however many she killed, however brutally she smashed them, they just kept coming, and with her fighter strength decisively blunted, she couldn't stop them. Perhaps she couldn't have stopped them anyway. Perhaps her hope of doing that had never been anything more than a hope, no more than a desperate need to believe she could do it. But whatever it had once been, it was only one more failure now. She inhaled again, nostrils flaring, then looked up at Ling Tian and Leroy McKenna.
Go to Charlie 7,
she said, and her own calm, even voice as she ordered her task force to begin its long retreat astonished her.
Yes, sir,
McKenna said softly, and she looked at Teller's ashen face on the comm screen.
Consolidate your squadrons, Jackson. I'll give you as much time to reorganize as I can.
Yes, sir. There wasn't a trace of condemnation in his voice, and she wanted to scream at him. But she stopped herself,
Somehow she stopped herself. "Once you've consolidated, detach any carrier without at least 2 squadrons on board," she said flatly. "Send them back to Justin and Harrison to evacuate every civilian you can pack aboard. You're authorized to redline your environmental systems."
"Yes, sir," Teller said once more,
and Murakuma nodded.
She leaned back in her command chair, watching the ravaged light dots flashing back towards their carriers, and her mouth twisted. At least she'd just made sure they'd have lots of spare life support for the civilians, she thought bitterly.
Chapter 10. We Can't Wait.
One inescapable consequence of the physics of the reactionless drive was that the instant a field drive went down, any velocity it had imparted went with it. The energy-shedding process, as the immense forces concentrated in the surface of the field's bubble dissipated, was spectacular but harmless, and the ability to decelerate virtually instantaneously from point 1C to whatever a starship's relative motion had been at the moment the drive was engaged could be invaluable. There were, however, circumstances under which the velocity loss required some inventiveness. And this, Andrew Prescott thought sardonically, watching Daikyu's master display with what he hoped was an air of calm confidence, is one of them. The battlecruiser slid stealthily through the system's outer reaches, creeping along, for her, at barely 15,000 KPS under cover of her ECM, while passive sensors probed the vacuum like a cat's quivering whiskers. Her course carried her directly towards the Justin Sarasota warp point, but that invisible dot lay 2 billion kilometers ahead, and she had no intention of approaching it any more closely than she must. While a coward would never have let himself be volunteered for his present mission, Andrew Prescott was no fool. He was confident he could spot and evade any enemies which weren't cloaked, but even though his scanners hadn't found any, the presence of cloaked bug pickets was a certainty, and logic suggested there were more of them than there were of him. He looked around the bridge once more, and his mouth quirked at the duty watch's tense body language. The last 3 weeks had been nerve-wracking for his subordinates, but those same weeks had held another, even deeper strain for him. The others were concerned primarily only with surviving. He was responsible for the success of his mission as well. His half-smile vanished at the thought, for if his ship had evaded all enemies, her consort Longsword hadn't. He couldn't be certain, but he suspected Captain Dalton had gotten too close to the warp point, either to probe it or in an effort to get a courier drone to Sarasota, 5 days ago. Whatever his intention, Longsword had been detected, ambushed, and destroyed with all hands. Daikyu had been just close enough to catch the omnidirectional code Omega, which confirmed her destruction, and Andrew Prescott was determined the bugs would not get his ship as well. Daikyu had a job to do, and to do it, she must survive. But she also had to know what was going on, and trickier still, whether or not what she knew was important enough to report. Just securing the data was hard enough, as his present elaborate maneuvers illustrated, but it was easier than deciding when that data was vital enough to risk passing it on. He'd made up his mind at the outset not to make any reports that weren't vital, and Longsword's destruction reconfirmed his determination, for there was no way the bugs could miss a transiting courier drone. Even assuming they didn't manage to backtrack it to Daikyu, its mere existence would tell them Longsword hadn't been the only spy left to watch them, and their efforts to find Daikyu would redouble if they knew positively that she was there to be found. Worse, it might cause them to rethink whatever deployment had inspired him to send the drone in the first place, and unless he was in a position to see any changes they made and report them to Sarasota, those changes could turn his original message into a trap. The same considerations applied to recon drones. An RD was a low-signature object, with every built-in stealth feature the TFN could devise, but even the stealthiest drone's drive field could be spotted under the wrong circumstances, especially at close quarters, and he needed to get his RD right on top of the warp point. Redemption couldn't be risked on questionable data. He had to reduce the uncertainty factor to the absolute minimum. The problem was to somehow get the damned thing to point-blank range without using its drive, and he and Fred Kazuka, his exec, had racked their brains to find a way. The actual suggestion had been Kazuka's,
but like everything else, the final responsibility for its success or failure was Andrew Foot Prescott's. He grimaced at the familiar thought, then sighed.
There were times he'd wished he'd told Murakuma to hand the stinking job to some other captain.
But someone had to do it, and he'd accepted it because it had to be done. And, he admitted privately, because deep down inside he was convinced he could do it better than anyone else. "Well, Mr. Wonderful, if you're so hot, it's about time you prove it," he thought, and glanced at his astrogator. "On profile?" he asked quietly.
"Yes, sir. Coming up on Release Point in..."
Lieutenant Commander Belliard glanced at the countdown ticking away in a corner of his display.
8 minutes.
Good. Prescott looked at his TAC officer. Status on the bird, Jill.
Just completed the final diagnostic, Skipper.
Lieutenant Commander Cesiano popped a chip out of her console, loaded it into a message board, and handed it to him, and he glanced over it. Every system checked, as he'd expected from Cesiano, and he handed it back with a nod.
Outstanding. Now if everything works, we may even get away with it.
The TAC officer grinned, and he smiled back at her as he felt the rest of the bridge crew respond to his wry tone. Funny how even really bright people can be amused by stupid jokes, he thought, and settled into his command chair to watch the final minutes limp into eternity. "Stand by for release," Cesiano said finally, and Prescott tipped his chair back and steepled his hands across his flat belly. All he could really do at a moment like this was try even harder to radiate confidence and...
"Drone away," Cesiano said,
and Prescott's eyes narrowed. The RD's low signature materials made it all but invisible, even to Daikyu's sensors, and it radiated no active emissions at all. Even its drive was down. Indeed, Cesiano's missile crews had physically disabled it, just in case.
And it stopped dead as it penetrated Daikyu's drive field.
But a readied tractor jerked it instantly back into motion. It couldn't accelerate without a drive of its own, but the tractor tugged it bodily along, imparting the momentum of Daikyu's velocity. It couldn't maneuver or change course, but it also offered no betraying energy source to warn anyone it was coming, and its present heading would take it directly past the Sarasota warp point in almost exactly 36 hours, at a range of less than 15 light seconds. And in the meantime...
"Execute breakaway," he said.
"Aye, aye, sir," Belliard responded.
"Executing now."
Cesiano cut the tractor, and Daikyu looped up and away from the drone. The range opened gradually, and Prescott inhaled in satisfaction as it vanished from even Daikyu's ken 4 minutes later. It was unlikely in the extreme that anyone would see it coming, but that left the trickiest part still to accomplish. First, Daikyu had to up her speed, and consequent chance of detection, enough to circle round the warp point to catch the drone at the appointed rendezvous on the far side. And then, Andrew Prescott told himself, I have to decide if the result of the exercise is worth breaking silence to inform Sarasota. He grimaced again and looked at the chronometer. 3 days. The time he knew was not going to pass quickly.
They're coming over us! They're coming over us!
An explosion roared over the link, and the voice in Acting Major Frida Yeager's earbug went from a tenor shout to a soprano scream. The link brought the terrible concussion right into her command vehicle with her, slamming her head aside in involuntary reflex as her mind pictured the carnage with masochistic clarity and her hands fisted. Somehow the transmitter at the other end had survived the explosion, and she heard the scream collapse into a horrible, high-pitched, endless sound of agony before her comm officer could cut the circuit. Yeager drew a deep breath and shook herself. Lieutenant Furness wasn't the first to die since the bugs came to Justin. He won't be the last either, her mind said grimly, but he'd blown hell out of the bug point before they called in the heavy stuff on him. She dropped her eyes to the map display. So far, the bugs didn't seem to have sorted the recon satellites out of all the other orbital junk, but Brigadier Mondesi, she corrected herself, wasn't taking chances. A sneaky opponent might opt for planting scanners around the satellites to track their whisker laser transmissions to whatever was receiving them. So Mondesi had them reporting to widely dispersed and unmanned remote ground stations,
and aside from short-range tactical traffic, all transmissions were compressed into burst transmissions and then bounced off anything but one of the recon or surviving commsats. Transmission quality might suffer, but there was almost always some handy piece of space junk, man-made or natural, to get the message through, and the tight beams were virtually undetectable. Which was good, because hiding things like Jaeger's ASP command vehicle from an enemy who controlled the high orbitals was hard enough, without radiating, "Oh, kill me now," emission signatures. In fact, she would have preferred to command her battalion of Marines, peace forcers, and civilians from her battle armor and a hole in the ground that gave the bugs nothing at all to spot. Unfortunately, she had too many civilians and peace forcers, and too few armored raiders to make that practical. Worse, her force was spread so thin and so widely dispersed that she needed all the command and control capability she could get, and in that respect, an ASP was vastly superior to anything even a raider Zoot could provide. For what it was worth, she glared at the display as the ASP's computers turned Furness's position from green to crimson. The Bugs' operational doctrine sucked, and they didn't appear to have any equivalent of the Corps Zoots, but the bastards were incredibly fast and strong even without it. The intelligence puke's best guess was that they came from a high-grav world, though none of the planets Argive had reported had been massive enough to account for it. That was an unsettling thought. Jaeger had seen the population estimates intelligence had formed based on Commodore Braun's report, and if that many bugs lived in a star system that didn't even contain their home world. Jaeger snarled at her own wandering thoughts. Fatigue. I've got to find a way to get at least some shut-eye, or my brain's going to go straight to mush. But how the hell am I supposed to do that when the bastards keep coming this way? She forced her mind back to the present. Whatever their home world was, the Bugs' strength let them carry weapons almost as heavy as a Zooted raider's, and they could scuttle through even close terrain with dreadful flowing speed. Man for man, though applying the term man to a bug, however obliquely, made Jaeger gag mentally. They were far better armed than most of her non-Marines, and much faster. Without Zoots or vehicles, it was desperately difficult for any of the Justin Defense Forces units to disengage and break contact. Worse, these bastards were perfectly willing to launch frontal assaults and accept incredible losses to get in among her positions. And once they did, their firepower made them hideously effective killers. But that same attack mentality could be used against them. For all their individual firepower, they were only sparsely equipped with support weapons. And Mondesi's Marines had quickly taught their hodgepodge of police and civilians to show them targets in order to suck them into prepared fire sacks. If they took the bait, the support squads lurking in ambush could inflict massive casualties, and their own aggressiveness kept them coming when any Terran unit would have broken off, which only increased the body count. The defenders had managed to destroy more than one attack force down to the last bug, which, she thought grimly, seems to be the only way to guarantee breaking contact. Furness, unfortunately, hadn't, and she'd been unable to reinforce in time to save his platoon. Not at any rate without committing her Zoots or handful of remaining assault skimmers, and she had to be extremely careful how she moved those. The energy they radiated moving at speed was painfully visible from orbit, and the defenders had learned the hard way that the bugs were perfectly willing to nuke any juicy target they saw. But at least Furness had drawn the attack onto his own unit, and its fight to the death had diverted the bugs from the refugee camp long enough for its occupants to scatter into the hills. Some would be caught by the clumsy helicopters, which seemed to be the bugs' only tactical aircraft. But the bugs had learned, also the hard way, what happened to any chopper that encountered a Marine with an HVM. The man-portable hypervelocity missile moved at 10% of light speed, giving them energy weapon accuracy over any tactical range, and the kinetic energy released when they struck their target was far worse than merely devastating. "Have Blocker 1-1 move down the valley to here," Jaeger said, and dropped an icon into the display. "Blocker 1-5 and Backup 0-4 can cover them from overwatch here and here." Two more icons appeared atop hills flanking the valley. "Inform Lieutenant Harp that his mission is to delay the bugs. He's buying time for the refugees to get clear, not trying to wipe the bastards out.
So tell him I'm going to rip him a new asshole if he forgets it.
Yes, sir.
Her comm officer bent over his own panel, inputting the orders and instructing his systems to compress them for burst transmission, and consult the ASP's orbital catalogs for suitable bodies to bounce the signals off. Yeager left the ex-Peace Forcer to the task and looked over her shoulder at Master Sergeant Helen McNeil. The sturdy, auburn-haired raider had been bumped to acting sergeant major of Yeager's makeshift battalion, and the look in her eyes matched the one in her CO's. Harp was a hotshot who was almost as good as he thought he was, and he'd already pulled off 2 successful ambushes. Yeager and McNeil both knew he was just aching to make it 3, and that they couldn't afford the losses they'd take if he screwed it up. That was why Yeager hated to use him at all, but his were also the only troops close enough to turn the trick, and Yeager had lost too many civilians already. She would not lose a single additional life she could save, even if it meant putting Harp into the line. Brigadier Rafael Mondesi watched his own display as Major Yeager's overstretched battalion fought desperately to hold the bugs, and his face was ebon iron. His HQ's camouflage would have made even a Marine instructor smile in approval, and all his communications went by secure, undetectable landline to one of 8 remote transmission sites, which only made him feel even more guilty. It was an irrational guilt. The Justin Defense Forces CO had to have a secure command center, but that didn't make it any easier to live with. Whatever his collar insignia said, he still felt like a colonel, and a colonel's place was with his regiment.
"What's close enough to support Yeager?" he asked harshly.
"Nothing." His executive officer's voice was just as harsh, and Mondesi looked up quickly. He opened his mouth to dispute the single flat negative, then closed it with a snap. General Simon Merman was a cop, not a Marine, but he'd learned a lot in the last 2 terrible weeks, and half Yeager's troops were his peace forcers. If anything had been in position to support the Major, he would have moved heaven and earth to get it there.
"Damn,"
the Marine sighed, and his ramrod straight spine sagged just a bit.
"At least they're still scattergunning us," Merman said.
Mondesi nodded. He'd hoped his SIGINT sections might manage to at least track the bugs' tactical traffic, but as the Navy had discovered against their starships, bugs didn't seem to say anything to one another. The signal intelligence types had picked up lots of transmissions. The bugs seemed to rely primarily upon easily intercepted omnidirectional radio, but none of those transmissions carried anything his people could even identify as communications. They had to be carrying something, but the most painstaking analysis couldn't find anything. It was maddening and dangerous. If they'd even been able to tell which transmissions were addressed to military units, Mondesi's people would have been in a far better position to estimate what the bugs were up to. As it was, he could only guess in the dark. The bugs had landed troops in and around all the larger cities and slaughtered every human they found, or worse, collected them for later consumption. And they had sizable forces in the field. Yet there seemed to be no discernible pattern to their operations there. More than half Mondesi's hastily camouflaged refugee camps weren't even threatened. Others had been hit in overwhelming force and wiped out to the last man, woman, and child. But it was almost as if they attacked only those targets they happened to stumble across, and his total inability to predict their intentions made it all but impossible to adjust his own deployments to meet them. But at least Merman was right, and the brigadier tried to feel grateful. The bugs' attacks might be virtually random so far as he could tell, but they had left the majority of his camps unhit. Unfortunately.
"They may be scattergunning us, Simon," he said. "But look at this."
He punched a command into the holo unit, and patches of scarlet flashed. Each formed a rough wedge, reaching out from the invaders' main concentrations in no apparent pattern. Certainly none were angled to meet one another, but 3 aimed almost arrow straight at a trio of small green shuttle icons.
"See?" the Marine asked quietly.
Merman stared at the hollow for a long, silent moment, then inhaled sharply.
"Shit,"
he said, and Mondesi nodded again.
"Exactly. And about..."
He glanced at the estimate his ops officer had put together that morning. 12 more days, they're going to reach 3 of our alpha sites."
"Can we adjust?"
Merman asked tightly.
"Some, but
but we place the original camps in relation to the planned evac sites. If we start moving large bodies of refugees around, the bugs are almost certain to spot at least some of them. If they do, they'll attack in force. But if we don't move them, they won't be able to reach any of the other evac sites in time to be picked up, without one hell of a lot more notice than the fleet's going to be able to give us. Which means?
Merman was a policeman, but his tone said he already knew what Mondesi was going to tell him. Unfortunately, he was right.
Which means, the Marine said heavily, that if the Navy doesn't launch redemption within the next 10 days, we'll have only two choices. Move the refugees anyway, and hope at least some survive to reach a backup site, or leave them where they are. And if we do that, at least 12,000 people we might have been able to get out won't have any place to get out to.
Andrew Prescott sat in his command chair once more. The last 3 days had been more nerve-wracking than usual, for there were even more bug scouts swarming about the warp point than he'd feared, and their courses carried them further out from it than he'd anticipated. At one point he'd actually had to shut down everything, including Daikyu's drive field, and imitate a drifting hunk of rock, and his forehead had been a solid sheet of sweat as the prowling light cruiser passed within less than 8,000 kilometers of his ship. If it had seen her and popped off a broadside while her drive was down, a single hit would have vaporized his command. As it happened, it hadn't spotted Daikyu, but the delay had put them 12 hours behind schedule to collect the RD. Given the fact that they knew its exact course, that shouldn't pose any problem, but the damn thing would be so hard to spot on passive, even for the people who'd launched it, that he couldn't help sweating every minute until it was safely back aboard, and...
Contact.
He sat up straight as Lieutenant Commander Cesiano's quiet announcement broke the stillness.
002 by 005. It's definitely the drone, Skipper.
Very good, Jill, Prescott said equally quietly, then looked at his exec. Nudge us a little closer, Fred. I want the weakest tractor we can generate to pull it in.
Aye, aye, sir.
Kasuga nodded to Belliard, and Daikyu moved to match vectors with her offspring. It took another 15 minutes of slow, careful maneuvering, and then Cesiano stabbed the drone with a tractor.
Got it, Skip,
she announced, and a quiet rustle of approval ran around the bridge.
Well executed, everyone. Prescott said sincerely, as Belliard altered course without orders and took the ship away from the rendezvous point on the prearranged vector.
The captain watched his plot a moment longer, then rose, crossed to Cesiano's station, and frowned as data began to scroll across the bottom of her display. Most of her screen was occupied by a map of the warp point's immediate environs, which showed the dense clouds of mines he'd expected. But something else had been added, and he leaned over her shoulder to tap the sphere of small red dots which represented individual starships just outside the minefields.
"Are those what I think they are?" he asked, and Cesiano nodded.
"Definitely those CAs we saw earlier, Skipper."
Prescott rubbed his chin.
They'd spotted a bevy of commercial-drive, heavy cruiser-sized vessels moving across the system at a suspiciously low speed, even for bugs, 2 weeks earlier, and he'd decided to risk coming in close for a better look.
They already knew the bugs used military drives, not civilian ones, in the light cruisers of their assault fleet, probably because the less massive military units let them devote more mass to weapons in units which were, after all, designed to be expended in action. The fact that the mystery CAs used commercial engines had thus suggested that they, at least, weren't intended for the assault role. While low top speeds wouldn't be much of a problem for a simultaneous transit, they wouldn't have far to go. Such slow units could hope neither to catch an enemy nor to run away from one under normal combat conditions. That suggested they were another specialized unit, and their present deployment certainly appeared to confirm his original guess as to what their purpose was.
Makes sense, too, he thought grudgingly as he watched still more data appear. We haven't used SBM Hawks yet, so they may not know we can send missiles through a warp point, but they have to know we could use our own assault fleet. These suckers may be tactically slow, but fitting them with commercial engines gives them a decent strategic speed,
and that lets them build them back home, then send them forward under their own power, and save the time we spend putting OWPs together in forward systems. They're smaller than most forts, but enough should still do the trick, and if all they have are weapons and defenses...
He shook free of his thoughts and looked back up at Cezanne. Any sign of heavy units in close to the point?
No, sir,
the TAC officer replied, and her tone mirrored the cold satisfaction of her eyes as she looked up at her CO. In fact, she tapped a function key, and Prescott smiled a shark smile as he watched her display. The drone had caught a cluster of over 30 super dreadnoughts falling back from the warp point once the cruiser sphere was in place.
"Looks like these fellows," says Yanyo, tapped her display, "are pulling back to join the rest of their battle line."
"So it does," Prescott murmured.
He patted her shoulder and walked slowly back to his chair while his mind raced. It appeared the bugs had at least one thing in common with humans. They couldn't remain at general quarters indefinitely either, and they'd been rotating their battle line units on the warp point ever since taking the system. As one group of units reached the end of its GQ endurance, it fell back to over 2 light minutes, well outside the weapons envelope of any attacker, and another replaced it. It was a reasonable move to protect their capital ships from surprise attack, but if they'd turned responsibility for the close-in defenses over to the CAs... He settled into the chair, tipped it back, and rested his heels on the repeater plot, as he thought.
Before detaching his ship, Murakuma had brought him up to speed on her anticipated reinforcement schedule.
Assuming it had been met, she wouldn't have received much in the way of additional ships yet, but she should have received at least the first wave of SBM Hawks. If she had, and if the second-generation AMBAMs had also arrived, the bug's shift in deployments might just offer her a chance to remount Redemption after all. Unfortunately, she didn't know that, and if he used a courier drone to tell her, the bugs would know he had. Would they revert to their original dispositions and back up the CAs with capital ships once more? He certainly would, but the Navy had already learned that human-style logic could be no more than a way to screw up with confidence where the bugs were concerned. He pursed his lips as he considered another point.
If Murakuma's munitions hadn't arrived,
she'd be unable to do anything with his data even if it got through to her, in which case he'd have risked warning the bugs to change their strategy and incidentally risked Daikyu's own detection and destruction as well, for nothing. It was tempting to wait, but Brigadier Mondesi was still getting transmissions out from Justin A3. The Brigadier didn't know where they went after they hit the stealthed commsats, and since setting out to deploy the RD, Prescott had been unable to tap his own end of the satellite chain, which brought the transmissions back from the support freighters in Justin B., but the Marine CO's reports made grim reading. If Redemption wasn't launched within the next week to 10 days, there wouldn't be much of anyone left to rescue. Captain Andrew Prescott scowled as he faced the decision he had to make, then sighed, sat up straight, and looked at his comm officer.
"So that's the situation, ladies and gentlemen," Leroy McKenna said.
Marcus LeBlanc sat quietly, showing no sign of his own worry, as McKenna and Ling Tian finished their presentation to the task group and battle group COs. Murakama nodded to them, and they put the hollow of the Justin A system on hold and resumed their seats. She gazed at the display, then looked around at her assembled flag officers.
"Captain Prescott's done an outstanding job," she said. "Now it's up to us to do ours."
A sort of ripple ran through the admirals and commodores. Jackson Teller, John Ludendorff, and Demosthenes Waldeck, as her senior officers, looked at one another, and then Waldeck cleared his throat.
Should we assume from your statement that you intend to launch Operation Redemption on the basis of this information, sir?
He asked carefully.
I do, she said flatly.
Waldeck might have winced, but he said nothing. Neither did Ludendorff. But Teller leaned forward to make eye contact with Task Force 59 CO.
"I appreciate your desire to get as many people out as possible, sir," he said quietly.
"But I must point out that we haven't received a single additional starship, while Captain Prescott's report clearly indicates the bugs have been heavily reinforced." "I realize that."
Murakuma laid her fine-boned hands on the table and squared her frail-looking shoulders.
We have, however, repaired our damages and received the munitions we were promised, and your strike groups have been brought back up to strength. More than one officer quailed before her soprano voice's icy tonelessness, yet Jackson Teller was made of sterner stuff. He was junior to both Waldeck and Ludendorff, whatever the table of organization might say, but it was his fighter crews who'd suffered the heaviest proportionate casualties in the last two engagements. "I realize we can blow our way into the system," he said in that same quiet voice. "I also realize their decision to pull their battle line back should give us the chance to use our speed and range advantages to full effect in deep space. But if they close the point behind us, we'll still have to come to them to fight our way back out. And while my strike groups are officially back up to strength, less than 10% of my squadrons can really be considered combat ready. Most are still shaking down replacements. If I commit them to close action, they'll take catastrophic losses." He'd been careful not to say again, but something inside Vanessa Murakumo winced anyway. And then Waldeck spoke up.
"Admiral Teller's made a valid point, sir, and there's another one. We'll have 12 more super dreadnoughts and 6 additional fleet carriers within 5 days. With those reinforcements, we'd be in a much stronger position to—"
"I realize that." Waldeck's eyebrows rose, for it wasn't like Murakumo to break in on one of her subordinates, and her voice was flint. "I also realize, however, that we don't have the luxury of waiting. As Captain Prescott pointed out, the mere fact the bugs know he's reported to us may cause them to alter their dispositions, in which case even the reinforcements you've mentioned would find it extremely costly to break into the system. Either we attack now, immediately, or we give up what may be the only chance we'll ever have to mount redemption. And the people dying in Justin, even as we sit here, are civilians I have no option but to leave behind."
She glared around the table. As if LeBlanc thought uneasily, the briefing room were filled with bugs, not her own officers. There was a dangerous, brittle quality to her, one he'd never seen before, and he felt a sudden chill. He understood her argument, yet there was something more behind it, a personal something that pursued her like the Fury's whips, and he wondered suddenly if she'd somehow slipped over the edge without his noticing. He started to open his mouth, then changed his mind. Anything he said was unlikely to change her decision. That much was painfully obvious, whatever was going on in her head. And if she was starting to lose it, and God knew she had a right to, he couldn't afford to antagonize her into seeing him as an enemy.
"The question of whether or not we attack is not debatable," she said in that same frozen scalpel of a soprano. "We can't wait, whatever the arguments in favor of doing so. The task force will attack within the next 12 hours, so I suggest we all turn our attention to our ops plan."
She hadn't raised her voice, but Waldeck and Teller closed their mouths and sat back without another word. She ran those flinty eyes around the conference table one more time, then sat back in her own chair with the harsh ghost of a smile.
"Good," she said softly. "In that case, Admiral Waldeck, we'll start with the battle line."
Chapter 11. Recall.
"Of course, we all agree that the visuals, assuming they can be relied upon, are horrifying. But at the same time, there must be some rational basis for their actions. Some misunderstanding that could surely have been avoided if it hadn't been for the military establishment's vested interest in having an enemy to justify its own existence."
Hannah Avram smiled grimly as she listened to Bettina Wister's strident bleating from across the presidential reception room and watched the embarrassed maneuvers of people trying to get away from her. The evidence of what the bugs, the term was rapidly achieving universal use, did to occupied planets' inhabitants had discredited Wister's viewpoint in all but the most hopelessly blinkered of eyes. But she was still a member of the Naval Oversight Committee, and it had been impossible to avoid inviting her to this reception for the newly arrived Orion representatives to the Grand Allied Joint Chiefs of Staff. The formal speechifying had ended earlier, and at least that had been done on a higher level than Wister's, or even Prime Minister Quilvio's. President Dacuna had spoken for the Federation,
for his office still remained its visible embodiment. Despite all the unnatural acts that had been performed on the Constitution, it was only proper that mankind's highest elected official speak for humanity on such an occasion as the reactivation of the Grand Alliance that had crushed the Rigelians. The other parties had responded with every evidence of good grace. Privately, they might take a better-thee-than-me attitude towards humanity's current troubles, but they'd learn from experience that such troubles were best squelched as early as possible. Avram's grim widened as she watched Agamemnon Waldeck succeed in disengaging himself from Wister's diminishing audience. He might be a son of a bitch, but he and his corporate world fellows could be counted on to support the military, which kept the Federation's commerce safe from the Tangri, Renegade Orions, and other predatory types. It was a persistent fissure in their alliance with the Heartworld, which had been too rich and too safe for too long, and their one patch of common ground with the despised Fringers. She sipped her white wine. Something stronger might have helped her get through this reception, but with advancing age she found alcohol did less and less for her, and felt depression close in as it always did when she contemplated the political dislocations of the Federation that held her loyalty. The human race had expanded outward in three waves, punctuated by wars. First, the Heartworlds had received Federation-subsidized colonies, ethnically balanced to the nicety mandated by 21st-century notions. Then, in light of the expense of the wars with the Orions, expansion had shifted to the private sector under the auspices of mega-corporations, which far-sightedly seized the choke-point systems with multiple warp nexi, the gateways to the universe beyond. Then, after the Third Interstellar War had made Federation and Khanate allies and removed the Rigelian threat, the impetus for colonization had been provided by ethnic, national, cultural, and other groups seeking to preserve identities they saw vanishing tracelessly into cosmopolitan sameness. The result was a vast number of newly settled worlds with small, albeit fast-growing, populations. The corporate world magnates were incapable of seeing the Federation as anything more than one of their own tame planetary governments writ large, an engine for maximizing profit. Avram despised the game they played, but she couldn't deny the skill with which they played it. They'd amended the Constitution into a parliamentary cabinet system, reducing the president, still elected by direct Federation-wide popular vote, ever more difficult even with modern communications and data processing, to a figurehead. Besides, for all their power, the corporate worlds alone could deliver too little of the popular vote to control the election of the presidency. On the other hand, the prime minister, who held the real power, had to command the support of a majority of the legislative assembly, which the corporate worlds effectively controlled by virtue of their own single-mindedness and dense individual populations, the heart world's disunity and philosophical confusion, and the reapportionment of 2340. The reapportionment plan had been bitterly resisted by the fringe worlds for a very simple reason. Corporate world populations averaged close to 1.75 billion, while the average fringe world was fortunate to have a total population of 30 to 40 million. The Constitution guaranteed every federated world at least one representative in the Legislative Assembly, but the reapportionment had pushed the qualifying population base for each additional representative up to 10 million. A particularly populous fringe world thus might boast 5 or 6 representatives, while a planet like Galloway's world was entitled to over 200. Given the centralized cooperation of the corporate world's liberal progressive party, that kind of concentrated legislative bloc gave politicos like Agamemnon Waldeck enormous power, and they knew it. They see themselves as the lords of creation, Avram thought, looking across the room at Waldeck, conversing with a knot of his cronies. The hell of it is, they're right. Morosely, she raised her left arm, the prosthetic one, legacy of the Theban War. At times she found herself forgetting which was which, and took another sip of Chablis. She became aware of motion beside her and turned with a smile of greeting. The senior Orion representative to the Grand Allied Joint Chiefs of Staff evidently didn't share her aversion to booze. nor did most members of his species, which alcohol affected in much the same way it did Homo sapiens. Indeed, the Khanate had become a major importer of bourbon. In that respect, Klarat Zartan was atypical. His glass held straight vodka, and Avram had observed him sprinkle a pinch of pepper into it.